This is Puget Sound Now, a closer look at the people and issues across our community. Here's your host, Northwest News Radio's Bill Schwartz.
Washington State not immune to a nationwide nursing shortage.
Short staffing, high workloads, elevated burnout and stress, workplace violence and bullying, and to a lesser extent, inadequate salary.
What's led to so many nurses leaving the profession? How the healthcare industry addresses the huge problem? We're only a couple of weeks away from the start of fall classes in Washington's public schools.
For kids with differences like dyslexia, ADHD, and dyscalculia, going back to school is often a reintroduction to things that maybe don't feel quite so natural to them.
Important advice for parents of kids with learning challenges. And a highly successful businesswoman talks about her role as Alzheimer's caregiver.
She was very irritable. She was restless. She paced. She wandered. She shouted, which I never heard my mother shout.
A conversation with Shark Tank co-star Barbara Corcoran. Hello again, Bill Schwartz. Pleased to have you along for another Puget Sound Now. America's healthcare system has a nursing shortage, and what's the prescription to fix it? Let's find out more with the CEO, Phil Dickerson, and Research Director, Brendan Martin. They are both with the National Council of State Boards of Nursing. Thank you both for this conversation on Puget Sound Now.
Thank you for having us, Bill.
Hey, the coronavirus pandemic turned our world upside down, certainly reminded us about life-saving roles of nurses. And what has happened to the U.S. nursing workforce, according to your surveys, over the past 4 to 5 years?
I would start with kind of the positive first. So we have seen evidence of a workforce recovery really coming out of the emergency phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. And what our analysis pinpointed is it's largely due to a rebound among older, more experienced nurses who have opted to kind of come off the sidelines and re-enter the workforce of the profession over the past 2 years. However, you are correct. We also see evidence within the underlying sample that many of the factors that nurses long identify as, you know, the kind of the drivers or the motivators for exiting the profession really continue in 2024.
Yeah, Brendan, you surveyed some 800,000 nurses. Are they offering you insight into the reasons the older ones are coming back and also their challenges?
What we have seen is quite consistently many of the factors that are motivating nurses to ultimately exit the workforce long predated the pandemic, but are ultimately exacerbated by the pandemic. So those are short staffing, high workloads, elevated burnout and stress, workplace violence and bullying, and to a lesser extent, inadequate salary. So some of those issues have begun to moderate. And I think that that's why we're seeing kind of the positive trend among older, more experienced nurses re-entering the workforce. But by no means are we out of the woods just yet.
Do you have any indication that more are expected to leave in the next 5 years?
We do. So that's one of the core questions that we ask cycle to cycle. For this current cycle year, so 2024, about 40% of our respondents indicated an intent to leave the profession or retire in the next 5 years. So that's through 2029. A little over half of that portion was due to planned retirement. So it's really those dual trends, so to speak, that have us kind of pause a little bit when we think about the durability of the rebound we observed among older, more experienced nurses in 2024. Because at the same time, that cohort of nurses is also reporting to us quite consistently and uniformly retire once again in the short to intermediate term. So whether or not this kind of represents us capturing lightning in a bottle in one cycle, or whether or not this is a little bit more of a durable trend, you know, frankly, remains to be seen.
Phil, as we said right there, there was already stress, long shifts, burnout before the pandemic. How did that pile on these issues and create more far-reaching problems for the nursing profession?
COVID moments, right? So obviously that created an exodus from the field because of all of that. Now, as Brendan has said, we're starting to see that moderate a bit, but I do think that right now those problems still exist. And for me, I view this study both positive, but also as a call to action. So we can no longer think that the COVID problem, if you will. What we've got is we're outside of COVID. We can compare these trends back to pre-COVID, and these structural problems still exist. So we need to take these voices of nurses. They're not just numbers in a survey. They're voices. They are real people with real responses to us. And I think we've got to get them to the table with our our clinicals, our practice partners, if you will, our educators, our policymakers, our legislators, we need to create this call to action to have these discussions, to not continue to talk about them, but to come up with real solutions. And it is, I like how Brendan says it sometimes, all hands on deck. This is, everybody needs to be involved in this because it is everybody's problem. And at the end of the day, if we don't fix it, not only do we have our nursing workforce problem probably reemerge, but more importantly, that means patient care will suffer, and that can never happen.
Our guest on Puget Sound Now today, Phil Dickerson, CEO, and the research director, Brendan Martin. They are with the National Council of State Boards of Nursing. Phil, stay with me now. As an association, how are you trying to get pay bumps or other working conditions improved to attract and retain more nurses to the profession?
One of the interesting things is still probably going back to that concept of all hands on deck. Now, we're in the regulatory space, but we have a group called the Tri-Council. Tri-Council is ANA, which is the American Nurses Association, National League of Nurses, AACN, AONL, which are our practice partner, education partners, and NCSBN. My point of that is they're more in a position to actually affect the salaries than we are, but we're a part of that group, so we can bring these issues to that group. And that group, I just met with them yesterday. It's really interesting to bring it up. I met with them yesterday. That group is going to start focusing on these workforce issues. That is going to be their 2025 look. And so I think some of those discussions have already started.
2024 data suggests here in Washington State, we have a shortage of 13,000 nurses. So how are the hospitals, the clinics, rehab centers managing with fewer nurses in the workforce? Are they turning to visiting nurse programs?
Well, I think you've got, again, probably a multitude of factors here, but I would suggest you they are using some innovative ways, using some technology, telehealth. I will say the flip side of that is exactly what Brendan was talking about, though. The fact is that they're not solving all of that. They might have a distribution problem of nurses overload in one area and not another. That's not being solved. So you got workload issues at certain places and not others, which then loads, you know, becomes a stress, a burnout, those sort of things. So while there are some solutions in place, such as telehealth, they are not the total package that needs to be taken care of.
Phil, how is the profession changing so our community colleges and nursing schools can train people for the positions which require more expertise, operating computers and high-tech equipment?
This is outside of the survey, but I'm going to say the council is working on what we call our strategic initiatives for the upcoming year. And one of our focuses is that we realize there's going to be new technology, AI, and other things coming into the workforce. And that means that we need to provide that boost, again, that information into the educational space, into the testing competency space. So it is one of our strategic directions that is going forward for our next three-year cycle as well.
Let's turn back to Brendan Martin one more time, National Council of State Boards of Nursing. Tell me something else. It's a highlight of the survey that you found from your clientele.
So we've been running this survey, I think, as I mentioned earlier, since 2013. Mm-hmm. The 2024 nursing workforce is the most educated and diverse it has ever been. If you compare directly to the workforce that we documented in 2022, so during the emergency phase of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's also older and more experienced. And I think where that's critical, you know, the front end of the funnel for nursing is very sustainable. Like clockwork, every year, 150,000, 200,000 nurses enter into the workforce. But when you talk about retaining that kind of older, more experienced cohort of nurses, that means there are pathways for sustainable mentoring, that these folks feel supported when they enter the practice space. So I think that there's a lot of positives. There's more positives than negatives. But I think that that's why this is that kind of critical moment in time. I would echo Phil. This is that critical moment in time where we can really build on the early momentum that we've seen. And so that's why we need all of those stakeholders to come to the table and to work collaboratively and to listen to nurses' collective voices.
Phil, as the association CEO, give me your sales pitch. Why should a young person or an old person out there listening to our conversation right now get into the nursing profession?
We exist because no matter where you're at, one day you will need a nurse. You need to be able to have a trust in that nursing. And these individuals that are coming in, they exude that trust. They build that trust. It is an honorable profession, a respected profession. And so I would say there is no better profession. It's been my life.
And they are the lifeblood, as we said, of America's healthcare system. Good conversation about the nursing shortage and what we're doing about it. CEO Phil Dickerson, Research Director Brendan Martin, National Council of State Boards of Nursing. Thank you so much for being with us on Puget Sound Now.
Thank you for having us, Bill.
We're only a couple of weeks away from school bells ringing in Washington State. Stress levels go up for children, especially those with learning challenges. Here's Puget Sound Now's Lillian Beck.
Back to school season is stressful for everyone. From buying school supplies to preparing for a new schedule, this time of year is full of change. A new survey from Understood.org shows that these changes are even more difficult for families with neurodivergent children. Today on Puget Sound Now, I am joined by Dr. Andrew Kahn, a licensed psychologist who specializes in learning and behavior, to talk about a new program aimed at creating a smoother back-to-school experience.
For neurodivergent students, one of the hardest things, and let's be clear, for return to school for everybody is challenging, but for kids with differences like dyslexia, ADHD, and dyscalculia, going back to school is often a reintroduction to things that maybe don't feel quite so natural to them. Getting ready for going back to school is about reviewing IEPs and 504s in those cases where kids have plans, and also navigating some of those logistics like getting up on time and getting bedtime routines back in order. One of the things that we do a lot at Understood.org is talk about helping kids navigate and creating organizational structures. So for example, things like creating, you know, color-coded notebooks or having folders for kids. The back-to-school season can be really improved if we have a little bit of pre-planning, whether it's, you know, having a pre-arranged time to set up a conversation with the teacher or to send an introductory note that talks about your child's things that they struggle with and their strengths and the things that they would really benefit for. One of the things that's really important for us at Understood as a leading nonprofit is trying to get information into parents' hands to ease the transition, because we know how challenging it can be for our kids.
Why are these students so commonly misunderstood?
You know, 1 in 5 kids have learning and thinking differences like ADHD and dyslexia. But despite how common it is, the awareness of those differences is really sort of undercounted. Oftentimes, much of what we see in these kids' symptoms and differences are generally invisible. If you think about what the process of being inattentive looks like, sitting in a room and not really being focused, if you're not showing outward behavior that shows you're moving around or you're being engaged in misbehavior, it's very likely to be overlooked. What we also see for kids who have differences like dyslexia is that the ability to decode words and to look at words on a page, when that's challenging, all you're likely to see is the child's reaction. And if those reactions are misbehavior, acting out, crying, or avoiding activities, they can often be misidentified or seen based on their behavior, not based on those learning and thinking differences. So that's one of the really important focal areas to get information for families and to teach them about what's out there, especially through free expert vetted information like we have at U.org.
And to help with understanding these differences, a program called Through My Eyes has been created. Can you tell me about what this is and how it intends to help?
So Through My Eyes is a free interactive experience that we've created that lets you step into the worlds of kids with ADHD, dyslexia, and dyscalculia. Now, the platform uses real-life simulations in a gamified format. So essentially, you're going to be moving through the kids' day-to-day activities, whether it be at a hobby activity or at school, and they are narrating their own experiences, giving you a peek into their day. We also have about 9 videos of personal stories from kids telling you about their daily lives. And the nice part is we've created some practical tools with the use of psychologists and teachers and leaders to help us create resources to connect this information. Really, the key here is that by providing free resources that let you see kids' experiences in as close to real time as you can, we know that once you start to see differently, you can act differently. And that's how we begin to support kids and break down those stigmas that are affecting them.
How can we access this program?
Through My Eyes can be accessed at u.org/through-my-eyes. The cool thing about it is it's free. You can access it on any digital device with connection to the internet. You don't have to log in or share your email address. So it gives you a really easy access to going around and exploring the resource. And we're really proud of it because we were able to utilize so much input from our kids that were working with us, as well as experts who helped us vet the materials and put together resources that can really be used both at the home and in the classroom to help overcome some of these stigmas and misconceptions.
And outside of that program, what can parents and teachers do to better support their neurodivergent children?
So one of the most important things that parents and teachers can do is get good resources. And one of the things that I'm really proud of at understood.org is that we have tons of free resources on all the learning and thinking differences that we're talking about here, as well as giving people digital resource, content, videos. And the thing that we really like about the information is that it's all expert vetted and evidence-based. So if someone was to go to our website, they don't have to just know what they're looking for. They can ask a question for our AI chatbot, which gives them information, and this is the cool part, that is only coming from our content. So if you ask a question of the assistant, which is our chatbot, it will give you information that only comes from our podcasts, content, and resources that have been vetted by experts. So you're not going to have this random Google search for information, which I think is something that gives families and teachers a really, really confident feeling of going somewhere where that information is going to be accurate and supportive. And it comes from people who really understand these differences and how they affect your kids and adults.
How can people support the program?
So the best way to support the program, first and foremost, is to go to u.org/throughmyeyes and get involved in using the platform. If you like what you're seeing on our website, you can certainly go to u.org and donate and be a part of our process. And at the very least, think about sharing our resources. I think that the most important part here is to know that how can you find good resources? And when you find something you trust, particularly as a parent with kids with differences, share that information, share what you like, and get that information to your teachers, your loved ones, and share it with your kids. Because giving them that opportunity to feel understood is a great way to get them to thrive.
To learn more and experience the program, you can visit u.org/throughmyeyes. That was Dr. Andrew Kahn. I'm Lillian Beck on Puget Sound Now.
Staying with our back-to-school theme, if the shoe does not fit, many kids lack self-esteem and struggle in the classroom.
When you've got that pain going on, it's hard to, maybe impossible to concentrate on your lessons when you're in school.
Rich Lally is Partnerships Director for Operation WARM, a national nonprofit making sure kids in low-income families or underserved communities have high-quality new shoes and socks. What's on a youngster's feet make a world of difference, physically and psychologically.
You know, kids are aware of their surroundings, they're aware of what other people have, and when they don't have anything that's new, you know, they don't feel great about themselves, and oftentimes they might get teased by other people.
Research tells us 2/3 of America's youngsters are wearing shoes that don't fit properly, often hand-me-downs.
Shoes over time mold themselves to the foot that's, you know, going in them all the time. And if you're wearing a shoe that kind of over time has evolved to fit one foot and then it's in yours and every foot's different, it's not a healthy situation.
Using monetary donations, Operation WARM has manufacturers create all styles of shoes and socks, which go to community partners, many in our region.
We have a great relationship with the Washington State Council of Professional Firefighters, and they raise funds and then distribute our shoes and our coats to schools across the state. We also work with some of our longest standing partners are some Rotary clubs that are in the Seattle area.
You can find ways to support the shoe giving campaign on the website operationwarm.org. Well, the latest statistics suggest nearly 7 million Americans age 65 plus are living with Alzheimer's disease. It takes an enormous toll on the patients, the families, caregivers. And a person who knows this journey all too well is a television star, entrepreneur, author, Barbara Corcoran, sharing her story with you this morning on Puget Sound Now. Barbara, a huge fan of Shark Tank and all your projects, and it's a pleasure to meet you and have this really wonderful discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You credit your mother, Florence, with being your motivator. What kind of woman was she?
She's a number one, a powerhouse. I mean, she was a housewife for a mother of 10 children, and yet she ran that household like a boot camp. There was nothing out of place. We grew up in a two-bedroom household, And you could imagine six girls in one room, four boys in another room. And yet nothing was out of place. When she cracked her whip, we got hopping, boy. We were allowed to make a mess, but when she cracked her whip, we got hopping. Much more important than her organizational skill, which very much helped me in my business to build a big business, was her belief that everybody has something special. And she convinced us as children we each had something special that was different from the other. And she forced us to demonstrate our strength at the home front all the time. So we all kind of had to capitalize on a certain thing that was intrinsic to us. My job was to entertain people, to demonstrate what a wonderful imagination I had. So I made up games on boards. I made up games in the street. She always applauded me, told me everybody thought they were terrific. And I don't know how good they were, honestly, in hindsight. The best part of her, she was just a wonderful motivator that made you believe you could accomplish anything. And I went into the world at 18 thinking I could accomplish anything I put my mind to. And my mother was cheering me all along the way.
Was she a caregiver, and did she pass those qualities to you?
Of course, because I was probably the best boss I ever met, if I might brag about that a minute, because I think I took care of the people who worked for me and brought out the best in the people, because I was mimicking my mom all the time. So I really don't think there's a single thing about my personality that's original, honestly. Everything I did was a version of what she did at the home front.
Yeah, I hear that about me and my dad, too. Florence, her brothers, her mother, they all had Alzheimer's. So you weren't surprised when your mom was diagnosed before age 75. But what symptoms did you notice and start having the tough conversations?
Well, the earlier symptoms, in hindsight, at the time seemed difficult, but in hindsight, they weren't difficult at all. She would forget her keys, forget to turn off the oven, forget her best friend's name, grope for it. And when we saw those symptoms, we just thought at first it was age old. You know, she was getting older, and these was what happened when you got older. But about 2 years later, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And because my grandmother had grew up with us, we were very aware of Alzheimer's, and it was no surprise. But what was a surprise is I thought her Alzheimer's would be like my grandmother's, where, you know, the traditional things that happen with people with Alzheimer's, they lose their memory gradually, and you contend with that and live with them. But my mother showed symptoms very, very different. She never cried, but she was crying a lot. She was very irritable. She was restless. She paced. She wandered. She shouted, which I never heard my mother shout. And she kept asking angry, repetitive questions, like she was angry with us. We kind of felt that we as a family weren't taking good care of her because she was angry. I think the first tip-off was when three of my siblings who lived close to the home when she was well needing bed care took her to the home, and she was angry and telling us, "You don't care about me." And yeah. I mean, those words wouldn't be something my mother would ever say. And I think that was the first tip off that she was suffering from something else. And there is a condition called agitation in Alzheimer's dementia. And I wish I had known that there is a separate but related conditions that are similar, but vastly much more powerful and much more difficult to contend with. I've learned about it. Surprisingly, that half the people living with Alzheimer's show signs of agitation in Alzheimer's dementia, but yet I don't find in speaking with people day to day, people really don't know about it. I don't know why that is, but they just don't know about it. So I'm trying to build that awareness because I think it really needs it needs to be entering people's consciousness so they could do a better job as a caregiver.
Our guest on Puget Sound Now, Emmy-winning TV personality, entrepreneur Barbara Corcoran. We just honored a lot of our angels out there with National Caregivers Day. So did you take this on your family with your mom living with you in home, or did you have a caregiver person too helping out?
No, at first she was in home by herself just for the first 2 years with my dad. My dad kind of acted as sort of caregiver when he remembered to give her vitamins or remembered to feed her dinner. He wasn't such a good mom dad, you know. My sister Janine lived two blocks away, and on the third year she moved in with my mother, and she was the caregiver for probably the next 4 years. Then she moved to Pennsylvania, and my other sister became her full-time caregiver, who was, ironically, a hospice nurse, so she was well-equipped to really handle the additional problems with her. Right. And she and my dad moved into her home, and then 3 years later, she just needed total round-the-clock care, and that's when she moved into a home. It was a wonderful home who really recognized what was going on. When my mother was wandering, they didn't just put her back in a room. They figured out why she was wandering, and she was wandering looking for a laundry room so she could do the children's laundry. And they allowed her to do laundry 2 hours a day, folding the same towels over and over again. And she was happy. You know, they even allowed her to attend their planning meetings because she was very organized, and she would tell them what to do, which of course made no sense, but they humored her on that. And we all played along. And that brings me to what I believe was the most important lesson I got out of that juncture, other than patience, which I sort of learned, not learned it well enough. But I learned that the most important thing in being a caregiver is to never differ with a person who has dementia. We used to correct my mother all the time. Mom, I told you that. Mom, this is Mary, your best friend. Mom, don't you remember? I never, and neither did any of my siblings, ever say that again. Once my brother had taken a course and told us we were managing her totally wrong. So what we started doing is living in her space. If she said there was a snake under her bed and was going to bite her, we pulled up the bed and we killed the snake. A month before that, we would tell this no snake, Mom. We never told her again. My dad had died 3 years ago when she said, "Where's Dad?" We didn't tell her because it was too painful. We said, "He's out warming up the car." If she said she was a young mother and the baby was crying, we got a baby doll so she could take care of them. We just always lived on her side of the fence as though we knew what Alzheimer's was. And as a result of that, she didn't feel shame. And as a result of that, we moved closer to her.
Those are great words of advice because it rings true with my own mother-in-law. She would call and say, "I'm in this hotel. I'm working for these people. I don't know why, but they're not paying me very well." And we say, "Dolores, that's great. You know, I'm glad you found a place that's really good for you." So I understand. You can't argue because there's no win in that situation.
Yeah, but I'll tell you something. You're a very wise person. Most people do differ and argue. I see it all the time. It breaks my heart.
A few more moments now with Barbara Corcoran, a TV personality. You're a spokesperson, too, for Otsuka American Pharmaceutical. Are there new drugs or new therapies out there that will control the agitation that you spoke about?
There's always new things that can be done, but I'm not a doctor. You know, I can't give medical advice, but I do know that if you report changes in behavior to a doctor and ask about ways to manage the behaviors, I'm sure they have many solutions.
Okay, because you've been close to this Alzheimer's, you're also a business expert. If somebody can afford long-term care insurance, is that a good idea to bring on?
Well, the key phrase you just used is if someone can afford it.
Yeah.
You know, long-term care insurance, from my observations, is purchased mostly by people who could afford it easily. I think most people who are single caregivers caring for family members don't have long-term care insurance because it's too expensive in the first place. And then caring for the person while they approach their death is also very expensive and very time-consuming. I don't believe there is really enough good options out there to help people along at all. No. I wish everybody had that, but I don't believe that's the case.
Yeah, I know our own state of Washington has tried to do a public program where people can save a little money for long-term care. Every little bit will help in this. Barbara, looking back in our short time now here, what one thing, again, would you impart to our audience, something you'd do differently in caring for your own mom or for people out there who are caregivers?
There's nothing more important than walking on their side of the fence and becoming part of their world. That's what I have to say again. Nothing more important than that. And there's nothing more important than having the knowledge that you're lacking. And people don't know that. If you visit recognizealzheimersagitation.com, it's chock full of information. There's really no way you could function today and say, "I didn't know." I mean, I did that back then because there was no information out there, but there's plenty of information people could retrieve today to do anything. I just think this is part of it.
Give us that website again.
Of course, it's a mouthful. RecognizeAlzheimersAgitation.com.
Well, thank you for sharing, Barbara Corcoran.
Thank you
it's
very
really
much.
A pleasure to meet you.
Very kind to have me on. Thank you.
Many thanks to all of my guests and you for listening. I'm Bill Swartz. We're back again next weekend.
Thank you for listening to Puget Sound Now, a closer look at the people and issues across our community. Listen for new episodes every weekend and download full episodes at nwnewsradio.com or wherever you get your podcast. Puget Sound Now is a public service of Lotus Seattle Corp and is a production of Northwest News Radio, 97.7 AM 1000.